You.
All right, we'll see how this works here today. Out in the studio in the cloud, Warren Martin with Kansas Strong. How are you doing today, sir?
Doing good. How about yourself?
I'm not doing too bad. A little bit tired today as it's spring. We kick off, well, a couple days ago, I guess, technically, kicked it off. And your schedule's in full gear. What's the rundown look like in your world?
Oh, we've been crazy busy around here, going to schools and speaking at schools. Today I'm in the office, had a radio interview. Tomorrow I head out on the road again, doing radio interviews, speaking to a corporation. And then we just kind of keep rolling on through the rest of the school year, finishing up. We got tons of events, two different oil field appreciation events, Cayuga mid-year, Ecoga mid-year. All of that happens between now and the end of May.
Now, what happens at the mid-year and what are the events?
So we got both. There's two major organizations in Kansas that represent oil and gas producers. Cayuga has their mid-year. It's going to be in Garden City. And of course, we always are a big part of that event. And then Ecoga has their mid-year in Chanute, Kansas. And we are doing some educational training at that event. And then we're also doing a oil field workers appreciation event in conjunction with the Ecoga mid-year. So those are times for producers to come together. In the case of Ecoga, the producers will come together, we'll have our mid-year meeting, and then we're going to invite in all of the oil field workers from all over that area to come in for a oil field workers celebration.
And what do the oil field workers' celebrations entail? What's that all about?
So, oil field worker celebration is really our time. We realize that in our industry, there is a lot of events that happen for producers, that happen for people that are in the the executive suites in the upper echelons of the different companies that are a part of our industry. But there's really very few things that happen for people that are actually out in the field and doing the day-to-day work. And where, you and I have talked many times about how the oil and gas industry has kind of really lost, especially early on in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we lost the ability to speak on behalf of the industry. And it was replaced by a voice from a more leftist, environmentalist strand that came in. And what most people don't realize is that environmental strand that came in was very much a grassroots effort that went down to our students, went down to the lay people who are out working every single day, and communicated that message with them in an effective way to where they got on the bandwagon for environmentalism. And so our oil field workers' celebrations are really kind of a counterpunch to that. I think our industry has done a very poor job of helping people who are working out on a rig, people who are pumping, working the pumping units, that are driving the crude hauler trucks, that are doing the over-the-road hauling trucks, that are working out in the office in the accounting space or in the marketing space or the landman space. We've done a very poor job of equipping them to become advocates for our industry. And so the oil field workers celebration is really a time to bring together some of those lower echelon workers that don't get to go to a bunch of events like this. We bring them together, give them a free meal, free drinks. We give away over $4,000 in raffle items at every event. And our main goal is to really communicate to them how important their job is to their communities, to the state, and to the nation as a whole, and to the worldwide. And the worldwide impact it has in bettering human lives. And if we can help them understand how what they do is really advocating for a better humanity, then they become advocates for us at that grassroots level that our producers and our executives, quite frankly, are not able to communicate.
Do you find it's hard sometimes for the oil and gas workers to what it used to be, feed the family or feed the world and fuel the world, and now with how political and polarizing everything in today's world is, it would be hard to work in the industry and go to public events and have all of a sudden people start criticizing you for having a job. Does that happen in down there in your neck of the woods?
I think that's one of the biggest things that I challenge at each one of these events because, a good portion of the people, the men and women that are going to show up to these events, on the back of their trucks, they're going to have a sticker that says oil field trash. And that's something that was a negative that was put on our industry as a whole, that it's a trashy industry, it's a dirty industry, it's an industry that destroys the environment. And anyone whose natural response is you're being insulted, then you just accept that response, adopt it as your own personality, and move forward in pride that that's how you're identified. And so, really, the greatest challenge for us is really making that transition of helping people understand, yeah, I get the moniker, the oil field trash, but the reality is what those workers are doing in covered in dirt and grime and covered in the hardship that they're going through every single day is they are changing the world. They are providing over 56% of the energy the world depends on. They are providing the products that the world depends on to live in the society that we live in today. They are making a dynamic impact and really trying to help people change their identity. And understand that you can call yourself oil field trash, make no mistake of it, but you are because you're dirty and because of all these other things that because of the job that you're doing, you can't dig a ditch without getting dirty. You can't drill an oil well without getting dirty. But that does not mean that you're not making a dynamic impact on the world around you. It doesn't mean that your job is inconsequential or it's just a paycheck. It is much more than that. And that's what we're trying to communicate to these workers is that they are much more than oil field trash. They are much more than a hour by hour worker. And it is hard because especially right now with the price, oil prices being where they are, I mean, they're up one day, down the next day. We were at around $60 a barrel for almost 6 months straight. And so a lot of oil field workers got laid off. So it's not the most consistent pay at those lower levels of the oil industry. But then there's the boom cycles. It's a boom and bust type of environment. But every hour spent in the industry is an hour that betters human lives.
One of the things I wanted to ask you is because you mentioned the environmental side of things, and there was a pretty significant push, and it's pretty well documented now, 20-year, 30-year push to really frame a narrative on specifically the oil and gas industry. Could also throw coal in there as well. It's one of those things where somebody from the oil and gas industry could say that the sun rises in the east, but then the person would reframe the narrative to say, no, it rises up by New York. They just reframe the narrative so that they're right. And it almost became a real issue after, big major events, and we wanted to talk about the Exxon Valdez spill, which it's the anniversary today of that. And we've talked about this before about how I grew up in agriculture, and so I'm used to big catastrophic events. A lot of times it's in your community, with whether it's tractor rollovers or augers that go without springs. A lot of deaths in agriculture that go unreported. And so that's a pretty tragic thing, especially for communities and families and that sort of thing. So when the oil and gas industry has these big ones like this, what was the other one? Probably BP. So every 30 years, there's a big catastrophic type event. I look at what came from it because accidents happen no matter what. And so much of the oil and gas industry was reframed because of these big catastrophic events, whether it be ducks in oil and gas with the Exxon Valdez, and then it became the Pelicans in covered in oil. You know, a lot of symbolism, a lot of imagery. I can remember a TV show, Saved by the Bell, which was meant for kids when I was a kid, meant for teenagers, and an oil company was going to come and do something with the school, and Zach, the main character, had a change of conscience and flipped on the oil and gas company and everything along those lines. It was the hero of the show, and so it's and th that's the grassroots that I'm thinking of when you say that, is that it's been coming at a very peppered way. Almost peppered is the only way to, because it comes at a lot of different ways. But how do you help somebody with that when the context, when it's a war of context?
Yeah.
And oftentimes, you like I said, you can even say the sun rises in the east, and they'll say, "Oh no, it rises up near New York." It's like it's almost like a sophisticated manipulation that's being involved here. But anyway, talk to me about the context war that somebody who works in the industry faces every day.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. You're going down the right road in the fact that when I talk about grassroots, it definitely is the idea behind grassroots is not that it springs up from lower echelon and then spreads upwards. That's what they want to communicate. But really what it is it's a messaging campaign to get it down to the grassroots so then it can grow from there back upwards. And you're exactly right. I mean, today, Dawn Soap is still using two ducks in their commercials. I saw one as part of March Madness this week, and they're still using two ducks as part of their March Madness, which comes from the Exxon Valdez and the fact that they used Dawn Soap to clean up the ducks, and that was a huge campaign that they had back then. You know, you bring that up into Mad Max and Mad Max, the movie. Where is it that the bad guys live? They live in the old Exxon Valdez. They live in the old ship. That's where they're getting their oil from to be able to run their machines and their cars and their motorcycles. They're living in the Exxon Valdez, which had by then long been cleaned up. But the idea is to permeate this notion that whenever the oil and gas industry has a catastrophe, whenever we have a mishap, whenever we have a disaster that happens, it's permanent. And that's what the environmental movement wants to communicate, is that anything that happens to the oil and gas industry is permanent. If you release emissions, it's permanent. And that's just the furthest thing from the truth. You go back and look at what happened at the Exxon Valdez, and there were tremendous lessons that were learned, both in how to navigate oil across waters, how to change shipping manufacturing standards, but also how to do remediation. New concepts were developed to be able to get oil off of water, to be able to clean it up off of land, to be able to remediate the land and clean that up. We had a pipeline that busted here in Kansas, what was it, about 4 years ago. We had a pipeline that busted here in Kansas. And 6 months after full remediation had taken place, to where the land was returned back to better condition than it was before the pipeline busted, they were still talking about the environmental impact of the pipeline bust and how it was going to be years and years and years that this impacted. And that's where we really have to communicate with our own teams, with our own people. At the grassroots level, the people that are working on the floor, the people that are throwing chain, the people that are driving trucks, the people that are drilling wells, the people that are pumping units, they need to understand that yes, every industry has mistakes. We make mistakes. Sometimes things go wrong, but our industry does a better job and is more highly regulated than any other industry in correcting those mistakes and bringing them back to a right standing and even in better condition than they were than before the mistake happened. And we don't ever get any press for that. And that's the type of stuff that we need to learn within our industry at that grassroots level, is that we do a better job than any other industry on earth in addressing environmental concerns. In fact, we spend more money than the federal government has. Our industry has spent more money than the federal government has to address environmental issues. And you put that into perspective, that is an amazing statistic.
Yeah, I wouldn't know how to check on that, but I know that it would be very arguable. I mean, definitely, because the old, I talk about innovation all the time, and the only department that would beat the oil and gas industry, or arguably beat the oil and gas industry, is the Department of Defense, just because of the amount of money that's funneled into the Department of Defense. But that's the only thing, Warren, is that my biggest takeaway from the Exxon Valdez, when I take a look back, is the innovation, is the safety, is the regulations that came out of this whole thing. And that's the positives. And here we are 50, what is there, 50 years later, whatever it is, and they're still focusing on the negative. And that's the part that just blows my mind. And that's the part that I don't understand, even from the industry, really. How this happens on these types of things, because they do have plenty of access and seat at the table for discussions. And these are the opportunities to have the discussions, to talk about the double hull tankers and the different regulatory bodies that came from these different things. And to accentuate your point about the amount of environmental innovation that the industry has done, I like to bring up the archaeology aspect of it, in terms of that industry would be depleted by about 90% without the oil and gas industry hiring, archaeologists to survey a field before they drill. I mean, these are some real life things here. And with the environmental innovation, that's exactly right. How many small little things came out of this? They always talk about the microwave came out of the Defense Department or whatever. Same thing with the oil and gas industry. Think about skimmers. Think about how many pond skimmers and different technologies that came out of that. As I was preparing for this interview, reading about some of the innovations, it went from like 13 parts to 100. Like that's incredible filtration process that happened in the amount of times, and the amount of things that are being used right now in Qatar and other countries for water filtration, let alone oil and gas skim, that sort of thing. And to me, that's what I think of with your point about bettering humanity and the amount of environmental innovation. Couple examples just to put some context to it. So what's your thoughts on that?
No, I think it's exactly right. That's the part of the story that's never told. The part of the story that's never told, we've talked on this show before about how oil and gas, we originally started pursuing it and going after it for kerosene. And at that point in time, we had no idea what to do with the gasoline. It was too volatile. The cars were not in existence. And so we would refine out the kerosene, and we would just flow the gasoline down a riverbed, waiting for it to evaporate off into the atmosphere, because we had absolutely no idea what to do with it. We've gone from that state to where we are now, where we use every single molecule that we pull up from the surface, ensuring that none of it escapes into the atmosphere, and anything that might potentially escape in the atmosphere is burned off in a flare. And we've gone to where we're utilizing every single molecule in that. That doesn't just happen. That is a tremendous leap in innovation and in technology, in chemistry, in the ability to figure out how to utilize this resource in the most environmentally conscious and efficient way possible. And it doesn't just happen. It's come from a lot of trial and error, a lot of mistakes that have happened in the past. But most people, they just want to focus on the mistakes that were in the past as if that's the only way that you can see it. I just finished a book. I'm going to divert here a little bit. But I just finished a book that was a history of the city of Deadwood, Deadwood, South Dakota. And Deadwood, South Dakota is notorious for one thing, one primary thing. Well, two things. Was notorious for the gold rush and for the killing of Wild Bill Hickok. But Wild Bill Hickok only lived in Deadwood for about 6 months when it first was started up, and he was killed. And the other 99.9% of the history of Deadwood did not have Wild Bill as a part of it in any way, shape, or form. And even when he was a part of it, all he was doing was drinking and gambling. And none of his exploits happened there except for to get shot, yet that's what it's known for. And it kind of shows the psyche of humanity, the psyche of people. We tend to identify things by the most tragic thing that happens in that location or in that industry or in that lifetime. What's the most tragic thing that happens? That's what we identify them as. And we miss out on all of the great things that actually come from that person's life, that come from that industry, because we focus in so much on the negatives. And that's where I went started out with the whole idea of the Dawn commercial still using the ducks that came from the Exxon Valdez, movies that still portray it in them as if it's still sitting there floating around leaking oil to this day. We tend to focus on those things and we miss out on the innovation. And if we focused in on the innovation, it's the innovation of our industry that has created the world in which we live, that's created the products, that's created the resources that we depend on every day, that's made the world safer, made the world cleaner, made the world more efficient, and made the world better. And that has all come from technology, and much of that technology has come from mistakes and disasters that have happened in the past.
Was that Custer's last stand out there too?
Custer's last stand happened at about the same time as Wild Bill Hickok died. Of course, that was a little further north, up there in the Dakotas. But it all happened between 1976, or excuse me, 1876 and 1875, 1876, and 1879. That was the most historic portion of Deadwood when the gold rush was on and all of that was taking place, and Custer's last stand and Lakotas were finally defeated in battle after leading the longest war against the United States in history. So there's a lot of history that happened in that area in those few years.
And Custer, South Dakota is pretty close to Deadwood. It's probably about a 20, 30-minute drive.
Custer was named after him, but it has nothing to do with his last stand.
Okay.
Very distinct location, different locations, but it was named after Custer.
Now, you're talking about some of the most beautiful country on the planet, the Black Hills of South Dakota, from Spearfish all the way down to Hot Springs, go through Hill City and Deadwood. Deadwood's a great place to stay, and that's an interesting perspective about things are known for, the end, if you will, or the, the negative, which is true in a lot of times. It's an interesting way to look at it. Well, I wanted to ask you too about what people should do on these types of things because it's it's in vogue to make fun of things. I mean, Landman is certainly helping now, kind of turn that corner a little bit with the Hollywood movement because it's been my whole lifetime has been basically Hollywood against the oil and gas industry. And so it kind of got ramped up. Whenever that Greta Thunberg came out of the woodwork and mobilized the Gen Z and millennials to a certain degree. And that combination with social media really made it difficult for a lot of oil and made it tough for the industry. Something that they didn't see coming, something that they didn't know how to react to. I think of George Bush, you're either with us or you're against us. And that did trickle down a little bit to a certain portion of the oil and gas industry. So, what recommendations do you have for some of these oil field workers of all from CEO down to the roughneck? Because it doesn't matter, I mean, it's the same PR battle so to speak, at all levels.
Yeah, well, I think right now we got a prime time to be able to change the conversation. Like I said, Landman has been a big play as far as people actually talking about the industry, wanting to communicate about the industry. Second of all, I think that AI has been a big asset for the oil and gas industry from the standpoint of AI and the AI boom that is coming on. The demand for the potential demand for energy is so far and beyond anything that people can begin to imagine. It's unbelievable. Before AI really came on as its AI bubble, as it began, at that point in time, I was communicating with people and saying, between now and 2050, we're going to have to increase our energy production by 28% per year to be able to keep up with the demands for energy growth. That's an energy growth through technology. At that point, it was primarily data centers and cryptocurrency. But also the fact that we're going to add 1.7 billion people to the planet between now and then. The more people you have, the more energy you need. And so we were already in an energy crunch where there should have been a focus. I've been speaking for 10 years. I don't know how many times you and I have talked about how important it is to me, the issue of energy and poverty, and the fact that if we're not producing more and more energy every single year, more and more people are going to be pushed down into poverty. Then you had the AI boom that came along, and that AI boom really exploded, and people began to really step back and look at how much energy it's going to take to power the AI expansion that people are throwing out there, what the ideas, the theories, and everything that they're throwing out there. And so you have a lot of the tech elites that are beginning to backtrack on climate. Tech elites that have been fully behind climate change ideology, have been very much on board with the environmental support. You even have Bill Gates. And Bill Gates came out, wrote an article, and in his article, he said, we need to let go of false metrics like emissions and temperature, which, I mean, that's what the whole environmental movement's built on is emissions and temperature. And he was talking about how we need to let go of those false metrics and focus on a metric that really matters more, and that is improving human lives. And you've got a lot of these tech giants now and the tech leaders that are beginning to pull back from their climate change positions to really say, we have a bigger problem. The bigger problem we have is how are we going to produce enough energy to do what we want to do in the AI space, to do what we want to do in the technology space? And I've been saying it for 10 years. We are in an energy crunch. So that's kind of set us up to where you probably haven't heard any stories in the past year that talk about energy transition. They're gone. People aren't talking about it. They're not looking at it because the focus has come back to how do we produce enough energy? So that's where we need to really, in our companies, in our industry as a whole, really begin to educate every single person from the floor worker to the chain thrower, all the way up to the CEO of a company, and make sure they understand we are more than energy. We're the only energy source out there that produces products other than energy. We produce a whole lot of energy, 56% of the world's energy. But we also produce products that make life better, that improve human life. In fact, there was a study that came out that we're using in our ad campaign right now in October of 2025 came out that said that 96% of the objects that you're going to touch today, of the man-made objects you're going to touch today, 96% of them were made from petroleum. In some way, were made from petroleum. And so it's not just about some things in our life, it's about everything in our life. And when you begin to really understand that, when we begin to communicate it, that's when it really begins to change. So it's incumbent upon us within the industry to first educate ourselves, to educate ourselves on how energy impacts poverty, educate ourselves on how energy drives the world and technology, educate ourselves on how our energy produces products that make life safer, cleaner, and better. And when we have that understanding, then communicate that with our teams. Communicate that with the people around us, because that's where real pride comes from. You go back and you go talk to someone who's doing some kind of monumental work, whether it was, I'll give you, go talk to a veteran. Go talk, especially veterans. There's not very many of them left. My grandfather was one who served in World War II. Go talk to a veteran that served in Vietnam, in Korea. Go talk to them about the pride they have in being a veteran that served at that point in time. The fact that they stepped up and they took pride for their country because they were fighting for something that they believed in. They were fighting for an American truth, for democracy, and for the bettering of human lives. That's the same pride that everybody working in the oil and gas industry should have. Because I don't want to besmirch our veterans. We would not have the nation that we have today if it was not for them and the sacrifices that they make. And you cannot undermine that at all. You cannot take anything away from that. But at the same time, without the sacrifice, without the investment, without the effort and the work of the oil and gas industry in the United States of America, we would not live in the world we live in today. It would be a completely different world. And so, I think that we should have tremendous pride in the job that we do, the industry we work in. And I think that, until we get everybody in our industry to understand that and to be proud of the industry that they work in and the job that they do, it's going to be hard to overcome the narrative that is put forward by Hollywood, that's put forward by mainstream media, that's put forward by Greta Thunberg, that's put forward by all of these environmentalists that are coming at us, that, I've met with them many times. And I've asked them, we've talked back and forth, and finally I came to the point and I was like, what you're saying is that you want to go back and live like we lived in 1850. And that every single one of them responds to me and says, yes, would that be so bad? And I look at them and I'm like, yes, that would be bad because most of us wouldn't be here because infant death was skyrocketing. Our life expectancy was about 50 years of age. GDP and gross domestic product was nothing compared to what it is today. Climate-related deaths were off the chart compared to where they are today. It would kill a tremendous amount of the human population on Earth to go back to that. Would that be bad? Yes, I believe it would be bad because I value human life.
What's interesting to me is how.
Sorry, man, I'll get off my soapbox.
No, that's
I went off
okay.
on you.
No, that's okay because I was having this conversation with a veteran the other day, and I know him pretty well, so our conversations are pretty candid and pretty loose. And I was giving him a hard time about. Well, no, actually, the chronology of the discussion, which is important for this context, actually. He was talking about his daughters, and his daughters are aged 18 through 22. And there's some war talk going on right now about whether they should send troops over on the ground, over to the Middle East. And he pays a little bit of attention to it since he's a veteran, and he was actually one that fought in combat, so he pays particular attention to it, as did his grandfather or his father, I mean. Kids' grandfathers. And so he's more or less thinking of his daughter's boyfriends and husband, if they would get drafted or called over. And he brought up about how he understands that for them, they wouldn't even know what they're fighting for. They don't understand what the word freedom means and what a lot of these different things that, his father fought for and he fought for, but there's such a disconnect over the last 30 years that he brought that up. And I thought that was just an interesting way to look at it. And I said to him, I go, I kind of know where you're coming from a little bit because I remember, because remember, I was a small business owner at age 10. And so at age 10, I had to do taxes and that kind of thing. And so I kind of would say to him that, you know, we go to these public events, and remember, it started out with you'd stand up and applaud for the military after the national anthem or before. And then it turned into the firemen. And then pretty soon it was the policemen. And then it was pretty soon the teachers. And I'm like going, pretty soon you're standing up for everybody in the room except the small business owners. And I said, as far as I know, small business owners are the ones funding the whole thing. They're the ones creating the entire system so that you can have taxes to have a military and have this. And I said, and that's where I'm like, and he's a small business owner, so he gets it. And you know, Warren, I think we're at that point now where there's so many layers of context that just the average person, I don't even know if they don't have time or they don't care or what the case is, because we all have the same amount of time. How we use it's up to us and what we choose to do with it. So the time argument's always a little bit lax on my part, but that's kind of how I view the pride thing, is that this current generation, and the example again I give a lot of times is how the grocery store replaced the farmer. And now that the light switch has replaced the coal worker and the oil and gas worker, and mining up to a certain degree too, the implications are a little bit broader, a little bit more different. They're not the same as replacing the farmer for corporate farms, because energy is completely different than you know, a lot of these other things. So anyway, that's how I kind of look at it. How I think there is a different value of what they're fighting for, and some of them don't even understand what they're working for and what they're fighting for, Warren.
Yeah, some of them don't even understand what it is they do.
Yeah.
When I say that, I mean we have become an extremely technical industry. We've become an extremely segmented world, where you know I can understand technology because I started out on DOS, and so while you give me a new app, in my mind, I'm thinking through all of the DOS, and I'm thinking through of all of the, even though it's not DOS language in most of the apps, I'm thinking through the language sequences that are all built in behind that to make that app work. My grandkids don't. They just see the app, and this is just the way the app works. And so there, and that's what we're experiencing in the oil industry at this point in time as well. You've got a huge population in the oil industry, especially in independents, where you have people in the industry that are in their 60s, 70s, 80s, that are still running their companies, that are still you know, part of that everyday process, that they can go back and they remember what it was like to run a cable drilling rig. We had a cable drilling rig running here in Kansas until one of them I know till 1994. And so they understand what it means to run a cable drilling rig, a Walker Neal cable drilling rig, to go down and spud a well to figure out. So they've got the process from that all the way to the high technology. They understand every transition that took place. That's a huge database of knowledge. Then you have a huge gap between them and a lot of the younger people that are coming up in the industry, because we went through that period of the 80s, the 90s, and the early 2000s, where the environmental movement convinced our young people that there is no future in our industry. So young people didn't go into our industry. And so there's a huge gap that takes place. The great shift change is coming, where those older people that have all of this knowledge are going to retire, they're going to die, they're going to sell out, they're going to get out of the industry. And then you're going to have young people, and you're going to have about 25 years of knowledge in that connect those two, that's going to be to a large degree lost, where the new people that are in charge of it cannot understand it. And that's why it's important right now for in our industry that everybody in our industry take it incredibly to be incredibly important to educate themselves, not just on what they do, but on how what they do impacts the entirety of the industry, how what the entire industry process is. And that's what we try and do at Kansas Strong, is help people understand what we do, how we do it, why it's important to you, and why it matters to the world. A comprehensive 30,000, you don't have to know all the details, but a 30,000 foot view level to be able to know how you fit into the entire story that our industry is putting forward in the world that we're creating. Excuse me. But what you find in our industry is you've got technical people. I think I've shared with you before. I've gone out and filmed a well that has been pumping oil for over 100 years. And we were going to drill another well right beside it. And so we put a flag in the ground. The company put a flag in the ground. I started filming from the moment they put a flag in the ground. And I filmed everything from the dirt work to the rig being brought out to the drilling to the completion of the well to the bringing out of the tank batteries, all the way to the flow of the well and the first oil going into the tank. What was amazing to me was I would have guys get off of their bulldozer and come over and talk to me about what I was doing. I'd tell them what I was doing, and they would say, "Can you share that with me when you get done? Because I know what happens right before I get here, and I know what happens right after I get here, but I don't really know what happens in the whole process of putting in a well." And so even people in our own industry don't know all of the steps that go into putting in a well, much less all the steps that go into refining the oil or taking those petrochemicals and turn them into products. And so it's really incumbent on our industry to do a better job educating ourselves on how to communicate about the job we do, our part in that job, and how it contributes to the whole.
Which, circling back to the oil field appreciation event, that is the gist and the thesis of that event is to not only have a nice dinner and have some fun and festivities with prizes, etc., but really it is, kind of a way to bring them in to educate them on these types of things to say, okay, here's what might happen on your day to day, but do it in a way that's not so much like a classroom setting, a little bit more engaging, a little
Yeah.
bit more. Go ahead. Yeah.
And that's exactly what we do. I mean, you know me, Jason. You can't get me to shut up. I just interrupted you right there. And but that we absolutely, that's the whole purpose we do it. The whole purpose we do it is to have just a few minutes, just 20 minutes to be able to, and it's not a classroom setting. It is purely a motivational and inspirational message about why your job matters. And thank you for doing it. And that's really what it's all about, because that's where it starts. You cannot have pride in your job unless you feel appreciated and you feel like it's important. If you don't feel both of those things, if you feel your job's important but you're not appreciated, you're not going to enjoy it. If you feel your job is appreciated but not important, you're not going to enjoy it for very long. You have to feel both appreciated and that your job is important. And our entire goal in these is to communicate through a motivational message that your job matters. You are important. What you do is important. And you are appreciated for what you do.
What advice do you have for people that want to carry that message beyond a group of like-minded thinkers? And boy, that not now that I phrased it like that, it might be one of the more difficult questions I've asked because the whole world is so segmented and segregated down to little silos and buckets and just people surround themselves with like-minded thinkers, and so they don't challenge their mind or they don't do much complex thinking. So it does make it difficult. But I'm doing this Route 66 trip this summer, and for us, one of the main drives, if you will, is to really celebrate the road and the personal freedom that was created by the internal combustion engine. Because at the end of the day, everything that came out of that Route 66, it was because of the internal combustion engine. That the freedom that it gave small businesses and families, the innovation that companies were allowed to create and do and engineer, That to me is how infectious and remarkable life can be when you choose to look at it from that point of view. So in the same way, looking at the Exxon Valdez or trying to help one of these oil field appreciation workers or anybody that goes to one of these conferences, how do you carry that message out to the public? Go ahead.
Well, first of all, before I answer that question, I'll get back to and answer it. I have
Yeah.
to show you this. I don't know if you can see it or not. Can you see that?
I can.
So that is me with Tow Mater. I was in Galena, Kansas this weekend. My wife and I went on a little trip to get away for a little bit. We stopped in Galena, Kansas, where there used to be 12 miles of the Route 66 that went through the corner of Kansas. And that's where Tow Mater's at. That's the
13 miles, but go
13
ahead.
miles. Sorry, 30. Man, way to correct me right in the middle.
Well, don't shortchange the Route 66. They only got 13 miles. Might even be
I tell you.
13.2, actually, but go
So,
ahead.
and Tow Mater's there, and that was the inspiration for the tow truck in the movie, the Disney movie's Cars. And the original is right there and has a story about it and how the guy that was one of the creators of Cars saw it and created the whole character around Tow Mater. And so anyway, stop there. You're exactly right. But what you're doing with Route 66, that's really what we have to do with every aspect of our lives, is I go in and I talk to bankers. I go in and talk to airplane companies, go in and talk to different, and basically the whole goal that I have is to really talk about all the things that they use in their industry and then bring it back to how it's impossible without oil and natural gas. I just went to a school yesterday, and which happens every now and then, I'll have a student that will challenge me and says, yeah, but besides plastic, I mean, why do we need petroleum? And so I just open it up right there and I say, okay, if you can find anything in this room that's made not using petroleum, then I'll walk out that door and you won't have to listen to me again. And then I spent literally, I spent 20 minutes with them pulling out, what about this? What about this? What about this? And me going through how petroleum was a part of that product being made. And so the reality is we're so segmented that we don't connect those dots. We don't put those things together. And that's the real key. The idea of a Renaissance man. And that's kind of what I am. I'm a Renaissance man. I'm a jack of many trades, a master of none. But I have my thumbs and fingers and toes and everything around me. I'm fascinated with the way the world works and the way everything works together. We've lost that in our society. That used to be what we were looking for in somebody, was somebody who could understand everything and understand the theoretical ideas behind a lot of different components and how they work together. Today, we want specialization. And I think the real key to how do we take that into the world is to break the frame that it doesn't have to fit within the world of specialization. That we got to break that frame and show how what they're utilizing for their specialization is dependent upon our energy, is dependent upon our products, is dependent upon the resources and the raw materials that come from our industry. That's really where that education, that enlightenment begins, because like I was in that school yesterday, and finally one of the students raised his hand and said, "So what you're telling me is petroleum is in everything." And I said, "Pretty much 96% of the objects you're going to touch today were in some way made from petroleum." And so, that's where we really take it into the public. But you can't take that into the public. I think a lot of times we get the cart in front of the horse, and we're really advanced or we're really quick to say, okay, that's really a great message. Now, how do we get that out to the rest of the people? Well, the only reason I'm able to get it out to other people is because I know it. Is because I've studied it, I understand it, I have a grasp of it, and I think a lot of times we get the cart in front of the horse. We're so interested in changing public perception that we share the idea with our people, But that doesn't mean that our people in the industry understand it. Where it begins is, I have never met a person who understands how petrochemicals and energy change the world that could do anything but share it with other people.
To me, one of the issues is being able to identify people that can put the dots together a little bit, I guess. An example that I used to give kids when I would go speak at schools or go speak at events on behalf of the oil and gas industry and what the 96 percentile. The 96% of what we use on a daily basis is even if you take a wool sweater. Now, a wool sweater is made from a sheep. And so let's just take that. Nothing made out of oil and gas in the entire wool sweater. Okay. So how was it manufactured? You have to go through that. How much of the facility that it was made in, and the machines were powered and made and created because of oil and gas. Got to go a step further, guys. Now take a look at the farm. Does the sheep eat? Does it need anything outside of just grass on the ground? Anything holding it in? Do we have? I mean, back then they used to actually put oil in fence posts because it preserved them. It was a way to actually help so you didn't rot them out and didn't have issues with the fencing. And it didn't work on everybody, Warren. But sometimes when you saw that you had a little bit more of an engaged crowd, you could kind of do a workplace exercise or a thought exercise that lay out the different steps, because so much of life is segmented into a game of Tetris. It's hard to grab the different shapes that include thoughts and put them together so somebody can see the entire picture or puzzle that's being out there. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes perfect sense. And I'll go back to your wool sweater. The vast majority of wool sweaters, while they are made from wool that comes from a sheep, most of them are sewn together with nylon thread. And so most of those even are made from, unless it was a handmade or specially made wool sweater, most of them are sewn together with.
This one was made with bone and sheep intestine, okay? This is
You're exactly right. It can be complicated when you start going down the whole road because, I mean, the reality is I've talked about how the number one indicator of where inflation is the diesel price, the price of diesel, because everything that we touch every day at some point is hauled by a diesel engine,
Correct.
whether out on ship or on a truck or both. It's everything. So you want to know where inflation is going, look where the price of diesel is. The price of diesel, which our price of diesel, while our gas prices fell this past year, our diesel prices never fell below what they were the year before. And so why was inflation not really being handled? Because diesel prices were high. And so diesel is a huge component of that. So you can take everything back to the fact that everything's hauled by diesel. So at some point, everything, they even grain that just grows on a crop, you can go into the fertilizer, you can go into all that stuff. But I don't think you have to go into the full puzzle of how everything is produced. I think that's important at times to show as an illustration how you could do that. I think what's more important is really for people to understand basic things that I think the key there is when you talk to a high school student that's really into gaming, the only thing that really matters to him is when you start talking about the 85% of the average gaming system is made from petroleum products. When you're talking to an artist that likes to paint, the only thing that really hits them hard is the fact that the vast majority of their oil paints, the vast majority of their pastels, their watercolors, the vast majority of the papers that they're actually painting on require petroleum, petrochemicals in order to make those products. And so really it's finding that connection with what is it you care about? It's one thing to sit back and say, yeah, I'd love to go live in the 1850s. I mean, me as a guy, I would love to just go out where I don't have to talk to anyone. I could just be on my own. I could be on my lonesome and not have to do anything. But you take away certain things from me, and I'm not going to be a happy camper. And it's really identifying what are those key things that are really important to your sanity, that are important to your life, that are important to what you value, and then relating those to how our industry has created them, how our industry has enabled them, how our industry has put them in your hands. And that's how you really drive that message home, is find out what someone's interested in, then tie that back to the oil and gas industry. There's a great article out that came out in the 18, I think it's late 1800s, early 1900s, called iPencil. I don't know if you're familiar with this. And iPencil is an economic paper that was written that talks about all of the hundreds and hundreds of people and industries that it takes to make one single pencil, where the graphite has come from, the wood has come from, the lacquer, the rubber, all of that coming together to make one single pencil. And so how we're a world-based economy now is what the article's about. I can't tell you anything that was in that article except for a whole lot of things had to come together to make one pencil. But I can tell you how every single part of a pencil is dependent upon the petroleum industry. I don't have to know all of those steps. I don't have to know all of those industries. I just have to have an understanding that when you're talking about oil and natural gas, it's not just the price at the pump. It's about every aspect of my life.
I came from the publishing industry originally, and I was a publisher for a number of years, and so you mentioned how you had a DOS training, and very similar with me as well. I learned on an Apple IIc, so I was doing a lot of the typing as well to create things. But in the publishing world, I learned on light tables first, and so when the software came, it was just light tables in action. And then Tetris came out, and then Tetris just became putting a magazine together, because really, whether it's blocks of text or, different advertisements or different photos, they were just different shapes. And because a magazine is a lot of moving parts, a lot of moving parts, down to where, you can't even have advertisements on opposing pages, and you've got to thread in certain industries in with different articles, and just a lot of moving parts. It was a very easy transition to understand the oil and gas industry. Extremely easy, because when you lay out a number of different magazines and work in the different industries where you can get sued very easily, you care about things. And when you care about things, you pay attention. And when you pay attention, you learn things. Look at that, Warren. I feel like I'm an 80s after school special here. But that's, to further your point, to have a little bit of that green horn turned into a butterfly. I don't even know how that works, because there was a reason that apprenticeships used to be around, whether it be, in the oil and gas industry, you go and start out on a rig, and in farming, you'd muck stalls and you do different things, because you need to learn these types of things so that when you get to that next level, maybe it's not understanding, different ads or different DOS codes, but it's understanding why you make decisions based on meetings. Does that make sense? You're not playing Farmville here. You're not playing big.
That's exactly what I was talking about with the great shift change that's going to be taking place, is that loss of knowledge going forward. And that's twofold. It's twofold from the standpoint of one, there was a there's wasn't nearly as many young people for about a 25-year period that were interested in getting into the oil industry. So we have that 25-year gap. that exists there. But at the same time, you got the other side of it where you have those older individuals that have the knowledge that that was their key. That was their job security, was having knowledge that no one else had. And so they didn't readily communicate it back down the pipeline. And that's what I'm trying to change, is I'm really trying to change this idea that you should be judged, and your job should be based on your ability to perform a task. And part of that task should be, can you educate the people that are coming into the industry? Can you educate the people that are below you within your company? And that those are both aspects that are holding us back as an industry right now, because we are not communicating it to the people that are around us. And it's funny to me when I talk to older people that are in the oil and gas industry, and I go off on windmills, I go off on solar panels, I go off on gaming systems, products, clothes, whatever it is, and how petroleum is a part of it. And they're all shaking their heads. And I'm like, okay, so you already knew this? And they're like, yeah, of course we knew this. And I'm like, why are you not sharing it? Why are you not communicating it to your friends, your family, your employees? Why are you bringing me in to do it if you know it? Communicate it, share it. Everyone in our industry needs to understand it, that we are not just about energy. Energy is our dominant aspect. It is what we do, over half the energy in the world. But we also provide the products to make the world cleaner, safer, and better. And we have to communicate both sides of that, because that's the one advantage the oil and gas industry has over every other energy source.
We got to talk about the velvet gloves sometimes, because that has really been a big part of the shift. You mentioned how there was a gap in workers going to the oil and gas industry, and one of the strategies they used to hire workers was money, was to dangle, big fat checks. And you'll make more money in the oil and gas industry than anywhere else. And that was their marketing, was the money. And so you're going to attract a certain personality. You're going to attract a certain culture if you're not careful. And before, there was a lot of family businesses. And so not only was it family, kin, generational business workers, but it was people they grew up with or people they knew. And that was important, because then they had skin in the game, so they cared about the industry, and it wasn't just a check. And when you attract people just based on money instead of value and ethics towards an industry, you get what you pay for, and so that's not to disparage anybody specifically, but that's to point out that it's kind of like when my I've had friends of mine that they move in together because it makes financial sense, and then they wonder when the bills get tight and they break up why they break up. Well, it doesn't make financial sense anymore. Go back to why you originally got together. You didn't get together because of love. You didn't get together because you liked each other. You got together because it made financial sense. And now it doesn't make financial sense anymore. And so, anyway, I just point that out, that I think that that's part of what the industry fights more than it cares to admit, Warren.
Yeah, I think that definitely when you have people that are not passionate about the industry, and that's I mean, you either getting a job for the paycheck or you're getting a job because you're passionate about it. I'm passionate about my job, and I don't have a very good paycheck. That's just the way it works. If you're you, but and people when they can't get people who are passionate, they offer the paycheck to get them in. But that does not mean that someone who gets into the job for the paycheck cannot learn and cannot develop a passion for what it is that they're doing. And so, I would say that if you're in the oil and gas industry just for the paycheck, you're in a very dangerous industry. because we have a lot of booms and we have a lot of busts. And those paychecks come and those paychecks go. And but I think, especially here in Kansas, the vast majority of the people who are in the executive side of the industry here in Kansas are in it for the passion. We're struggling on the lower echelon of that, and people coming into the industry who are just looking for a paycheck. And it's okay to hire someone by dangling a paycheck for them, but if you're going to dangle a paycheck, then I agree with you. You better start sharing with them. You better start educating them on the importance of the job and what they're doing and how they have an opportunity to grow and how they have an opportunity to develop. Because if you don't do that, then you're exactly right. When times get hard, then they're going to leave because the paycheck no longer meets that standard that they're looking for.
All right, let's circle back to the appreciation, the oil field appreciation, and some of the events you got coming up and speaking at, et cetera. But how many of the oil field appreciation events are on the calendar?
Right now, we got two on the calendar. First one is April 10th. It's going to be in Great Bend on April 10th in Great Bend from starting at 5:30 going through to 8:30. Be a great event. It's at the Kansas Oil and Gas Museum there in Great Bend. If you're interested in it, go to kansasstrong.com, send us an email. We can get you RSVP'd, send you information on it. Then the second one is in Chanute in conjunction with ECOGA, and it is on March the, excuse me, not March, May the 10th. Make sure I'm right on this. Excuse me, it's on May the 7th. May the 7th, in Chanute. And we're having it in conjunction with ECOGA, the Eastern Kansas Oil and Gas Association. They'll have their meetings all day, and when they get done with their meetings, then we'll take over that night, invite everybody else to come in. You don't have to register for ECOGA to come to our event. You just have to RSVP with us. Everything's free. We provide a free meal, free drinks, give away over $4,000 in raffle prizes. And so those are our two that we have on the schedule right now. Probably do two more towards the end of the year, but those are the two we have on the schedule right now.
All righty, Mr. Warren Martin. I'll let you get to your busy schedule here, and we'll catch you here next time, okay?
Sounds great. Thank you very much.